Number two, did the program exist before the oil boom? If not, have conditions changed since then so as to obligate the spending on this program? Number three, can the private sector operate the program more efficiently and more cost-effectively? Number four, is a good public policy that benefits the greatest number of people? And number five, does the program provide services for those who cannot help themselves? And it seems to me that, you know, we can argue about the politics, the numbers, and so on and so forth, but it seems to me in order for this committee to work as a team, you have to agree on some basic denominators. And I think half of you guys on the committee has been polled by the Anchorage News in that questionnaire, and it seems to me we ought to, as a committee, agree on, let's say, can we all agree that, is this constitutionally mandated? Well, obviously, we have to, if it is, we have to fund that program. I mean, can we agree on that, all 11 of us, on that principle? And
you can agree to fund it, but at what level is the question?
Well, then, yeah. But the first question is, can we agree to fund this? Does this deserve funding, or yes, no? And if it's yes,
I don't think we have any choice.
Then we go. But what I'm basically saying is that we should have some basic foundation of principles that the 11 of us can agree on before we enter into the number crunching game or the politics of the number crunching. I think the 11 of us can at least agree that if it's constitutionally mandated, well, you're going to say, yeah, well, I guess we have to fund it. And then from that point, it's yes. If it's no, then, you know, go on to the next question. But
of course, you're dealing with some politically sensitive areas.
That.
Is the permanent fund dividend constitutionally mandated?
No. Nope.
We're spending $400 million
That's
a
right.
year. Okay. Is the longevity bonus
nope.
constitutionally
Statutory.
Mandated? We're spending.
But then the question is, did it exist before the oil boom? The answer is yes. Mm-hmm. And what conditions changed since then?
Well longevity
Rodney
bonus
Vest.
Existed before the oil boom, but at what level?
Yeah, well, but then you had the Rodney Vest case. That's what changed the complexion. Those are the type of things I think we ought to be discussing.
I think they're vital, and I think everyone, I don't know of any member on the Finance Committee that would disagree with any of those things that you said there.
Very quickly, I would just like to draw a parallel between agriculture and fishing.
If we treated
agriculture the same way that we treat fishing, what we would do is that we would buy the seed, we would clear the ground, we would go out and plant the crop, right? We would weed that crop, we would fertilize that crop, we would raise that crop until the point it was ready to be harvested, okay? Then we would buy the farmer's combines, we'd line them up at the end, we'd send a flare up and say, harvest. Okay? They give them X number of time. At the end of the harvest, they would weigh their crop, they would pay what little bit they owe, go to the bank, and that would be it. So.
Hey, would you put all that in ready? Thank you, everyone. We're going to have more of these.
Sure.
Yeah, at this time, we'll call the House Finance Committee meeting to order. We do have a quorum. Therefore, we're able to conduct business. In the order on the agenda today, the first bill that we'll take up is House Bill 106. Then we move to House Bill 80, which is the increase in cigarette tax. Then to House Bill 169 and House Bill 170, which is the business incentive training program and the appropriation for the business training incentive program. But before we get to House Bill 106, the Hazardous Waste Reduction Program that we had recalled from the Rules Committee, I have a couple of brief announcements for your information. As you know, each of us in these little metal drawers have our House Bill 100. So within your House Bill 100 file now is also the copy of the Governor's amendments to House Bill 100. So if you want to review those amendments, they are now in your file. Also, and this is very important here, House Bill 154, which was our immediate supplemental appropriation, as originally amended by the committee last week, reflected a general fund amount for health and social service general relief medical of $1,984,400. Amendment number 5 by the Health and Social Services contained a typographical error as to correct amount for general relief medical should have read not 10984.4, but should have read 1084.4. So a corrected version of House Bill 154 has been requested and will be available through documents. So I wanted to note that for the record. You noticed it was handed out. You have a copy before you showing, of course, general relief medical 421.9, 662.5, and that should equal, of course, 1084.4, not 1984.4. So unless there's objections, we will go ahead and have that typographical error corrected. Are there any objections?
The bill is still in the committee's possession then?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Okay. Are there any objections?
We just passed it.
Representative Rieger?
Mr. Chairman, wasn't this bill read across by the clerk?
This bill was read across, that's correct.
I don't think
we still are able to make
this is 150
technical typographical corrections. That's the word I get.
Okay. Mr. Chairman.
We could ask Carol Collins for confirmation. Carol?
I did talk to Sam Cook this morning, and what it wasn't is you can clearly see on the sheet that the two figures are there, and when they added it, it was a pure typographical error on health and social services. These two here, and just simply was not caught, and therefore they said could be changed just as a corrected version change. But I wanted to make sure that we noted it today so everyone knew there was going to be a corrected version.
Okay, Representative Rieger?
Mr. Chairman, no objection, but I was paying attention to the changes when I voted, and so I think that's the column that counts.
Okay. Any other questions in that? Okay. The other thing, we may or may not have a little change in our scheduling this week, and I hope we're on with this also. As you know, on Wednesday this week, we have House Bill 118, which is commonly called the ELF Bill, scheduled for hearing before the Finance Committee. On Thursday, if necessary, we will also continue our hearings on House Bill 118. Hopefully, of course, by the end of the meeting on Thursday, we have heard from all those concerned who want to be heard, and our meetings will then be on Wednesday and Thursday, with Friday being vacant at this time, but open as necessary for anything that we haven't finished during the previous 4 days of this week. So please keep your Fridays open. The chances are that we will be having a Finance Committee meeting on that day.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Representative Barnes.
Well, I'm still thinking, I'd like to ask to be excused on Friday as I'm going with Representative Swackhammer to see the correctional program at Holland Mountain.
Okay.
What? Fiery?
You're going to study on how we might reduce the budget there?
I hope that's what we're going to do.
I'll give you.
I have an idea, but I think it's unconstitutional.
Do we have any other general discussion before we get into today's agenda?
I mean, you want to help solve the highway maintenance?
Okay, House Bill 106, an act relating to hazardous waste and providing for an effective date, as we know is sponsored by Representative Brown, Representative Mike Davis, Menard, Navarre, Copenin, Ellis, Elmer, and Gall. At the request of Representative Brown, House Bill 106 has been returned to the committee for consideration of a proposed amendment and reconsideration of the fiscal note. A copy of both the proposed Finance Committee substitute changes in the fiscal note is now included in your file. So at this time, then, I would like to recognize Representative Brown.
Are we in teleconference, Mr. Chairman?
No, not on this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. Following the discussion that we had on this bill, I thought there were some very good points raised in the discussion we had about fiscal notes and their purpose in reflecting for the full body the full cost of new programs.
And taking the comments that were made during that discussion, I met with the department and asked them to come up with a plan for implementing this program at a lower cost. The fiscal note before you is for $75,000 and would allow funding for the on-site technical assistance program, as well as some workshops, which will provide broad benefit to people who are not able to get in line for an on-site technical assistance. In working with the department, Mr. Chairman, it was their feeling that if they were going to be mandated to do new activities, that they should have full funding or funding adequate to accomplish that. So how we resolve that is on page 2 of the work draft for the second CS is to specify that within the limit of funds available, the department shall undertake these new activities. And the department felt more comfortable then that they would implement the new law to the extent that funding was available to do it. And we also, recognizing that we would not be hiring staff for this program, we would not have a separate office, felt that it was more appropriate to call it a program instead of an office. And so the changes made in the legislation are to reflect a lower level of funding that's proposed for the program. And I want to say that I don't feel that this will preclude a full review of all of DEC's budget generally, as well as the hazardous waste portions of the budget in the subcommittee process, but that this is a more accurate reflection of the cost of this new program, and therefore I would urge your favorable consideration for the package before you. I'd just like to emphasize, Mr. Chairman, a very cost-effective way to go. We're spending millions of dollars cleaning up hazardous waste across the state. There are many hundreds of known sites presently, and we're only able to address a fraction of them. So putting some of our effort into prevention is going to pay off in the long run. I feel it's a good idea and urge your favorable vote on this package.
Okay, so what we formally have before us again then would be the first committee substitute for House Bill 106 Finance, and I'd like to recognize and Representative Brown for a motion that we adopt the second committee substitute.
So moved, Mr. Chairman.
Are there any objections? Yeah, are there any discussion then on either the second committee substitute or the fiscal note? Representative Rieger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On the first fiscal note, in response to a question about the contractual line item, there was, in that $75,000, there was $10,000 for office expenses. And I guess I assumed, but I don't know this for sure, that that corresponded to the two new positions. But I'm wondering if, now that the positions are not authorized, if that $10,000 is in office expenses needed.
Either Representative Brown or Amy.
Mr. Chairman, I don't have a copy of that first fiscal note in front of me, but the proposed expenditures would be, as they're shown in this fiscal note, for on-site technical assistance and for workshops and seminars and to acquire reference materials. And I do feel that these are all warranted, and I'm not sure, Representative Rieger, what the reference was in the first fiscal note. Perhaps I can, somebody can give me a copy of it.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Representative Rieger.
Mr. Chairman, it wasn't in the first fiscal note. It was in response to a question when $50,000 was to go to the grant program. Where did the other twenty-five go? And the answer was $15,000 sponsorship of one or more workshops and $10,000 office expenses. And that's, I just had that from my notes. I don't think it was in the fiscal.
I believe some of the office expenses were to acquire reference and technical materials to underwrite the program. Did you have some comments on this,
yes.
Ms. Kyle?
Ms. Kyle.
Mr. Chairman, that's correct. The bulk of that remaining $10,000 was to go to acquire the reference materials and so on that are specifically referred to in the bill. It says that the department shall basically collect information and so on that can be then relied upon by other parties. It's never been broken out to any greater level of detail than that.
Please proceed.
Okay. Just so in this new fiscal note, the 75 only goes to the things itemized. It will not go to office expense, like office rent or general overhead.
Amy?
Mr. Chairman, that's how I would interpret it, yes.
Fine. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any further discussion? Okay, a motion?
Mr. Chairman, I move that we pass from committee with individual recommendations the second CS for House Bill 106 Finance with the accompanying fiscal note.
Are there any objections? Hearing none, so ordered. The next bill we have is House Bill 80. Okay, I've just been informed in relation to House Bill 80 now, we are on teleconference, and we do have two individuals that wish to testify. We'll call on them at the appropriate time, Mr. Neil Cooper and Mr. Dwight Lee. House Bill 80 is an act increasing the excise tax on cigarettes, sponsored by Representative Ellis and Kopanen. The original version of the bill would increase the excise tax on cigarettes from 5.5 mils on each cigarette imported or acquired in the state to 10 mils. Now, the Hess Committee substitute raised the excise tax on cigarettes to 15 mils, which would raise the tax on a pack of 20 cigarettes from 16 cents per pack to 30 cents per pack. It also amends current law limiting municipal sales tax rates by exempting tobacco products, allowing municipalities to tax cigarettes at a higher rate than they tax other items. Included in your file is a fiscal note prepared by the Department of Revenue, which indicates that the committee substitute for House Bill 80 Hess would increase revenues by 9128.7 in fiscal year 90. That's $9,128,700. Representative Ellis is here today to discuss House Bill 80. And we also have, as I mentioned, Mr. Dwight Lee, a representative of the Tobacco Institute on teleconference in Anchorage, and also Mr. Neil Cooper. So at this time, I'd like to recognize Representative Ellis.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and my thanks to both of the co-chairs of the Finance Committee and all of you as members for giving me this opportunity today. Mr. Chairman, you did a good job of laying out many of the main provisions of the bill, so I'll try not to repeat your statements. There's just one minor modification I'd like to make. If the bill were to pass in its current form, we'd be raising the mill levy and raising the number of cents from 16 to 35 cents. So the mill the translation from mils to actual cents on a 20 cigarette pack would be to 35 cents. And as you mentioned, there's also the local option to raise the local share of tax on cigarettes above the 6 mil statutory cap, and then raising the mill levy from 5.5 to 15, and no change in the 2.5 mils that currently go to the school fund, which is grandfathered in into our law. Let me just skip then quickly to why I believe the tax should be raised. And I'd like to urge all the members of the Finance Committee to think of this tax, and it certainly is a tax, to think of it as a user fee. Because there will be people to speak after I'm finished, representatives from the Department of Health and Social Services and other individuals to speak to the millions of dollars of disease, disability, lost productivity, and actual state medical services and expenses caused because of the use of this this substance. So in effect, the tax, the current tax levied by the state, does not pull its weight in terms of the cost to the state, certainly not to society as a whole, but not even the cost to the state. There would be, as you mentioned, over $9 million of new revenue raised in the first fiscal year and over $8.5 million in succeeding years. And I, of course, would argue, even though we have the prohibition against dedicated funds, I will argue in my capacity, serving on the Finance Subcommittee for Health and Social Services and in all the deliberations that we have, that these increased revenues be used for health programs to so that this substance carries its weight in terms of negative health impacts, and also for education programs to educate young people and older Alaskans in the dangers of the use of this substance. Alaska's tax rate on this substance puts us in the bottom third currently, Mr. Chairman, among the states that regulate this. And all states do have a tax on cigarettes, Minnesota being the highest at 38 cents per pack, and North Carolina at the very lowest at 2 cents per pack. This change would put us in the top third among the states. We would still not be among the very highest states in terms of taxation on cigarettes. My original proposal, as you mentioned, was to go to 10 mils, and it was in the Hess Committee, not at my suggestion, but at the recommendation of the member from Ketchikan, that we raise that even further to 15 mils. And finally, my last point is that this is a tax, or a user fee, if you will, that the public is ready for. In fact, I couldn't have orchestrated it any better. The budget forums in Anchorage and also around the state, in the number of small groups, people who are very much opposed to many other kinds of revenue measures being considered this year, who were ready to have cigarettes carry their own weight in terms of the state budget. There were people that said double, triple, quadruple, no upper limit on the taxation of this substance, because people recognize that this is one area that we can go after and make it make this substance pay its fair share for the state services that are demanded by its use. So with that, I will end my statement and try and answer any questions.
Does anyone have any questions of Representative Ellis? I guess the only thing that I noted that's different from the original bill to the committee substitute that's before us, besides the raising to the 15 mils, is the prohibition being removed from municipalities of subject to a 6% limit. My only concern in relation to this is not necessarily in relation to the tax on tobacco, but the power to tax, of course, is a power to kill. And by that I mean you can put a tax so high as to prohibit sales of anything within jurisdiction. And is that the intent here within the bill, to allow municipalities to have that option to stop the sale of cigarettes within their borders if they so desire?
No, Mr. Chairman, it is not. Simply, we're allowing local communities to decide, and I'm frankly one of those who tries to go along with the philosophy as much as possible that the best government decisions are made closest to the people affected. And so I think it's something that should not be prohibited, allowing local entities, local assemblies, or councils to make the decision of whether to increase their local share of the tax. And my purpose is not, I'm not a prohibitionist, I'm not someone who would encourage that kind of thing. I realize the negative health impacts, but I just think that I'm most comfortable with sales taxes and those sorts of things that reside as a local decision. I think that's the appropriate place for their discussion if local communities want to add on to the state tax. So my motives are not to have a prohibitionist kind of attitude toward this substance.
Like I say, that was my only concern, is are we getting into another series or rounds like we have with our dry villages and our partially dry villages and our wet villages? Are we creating municipalities that will be smokeless and then having problems about bringing cigarettes in from another municipality to be consumed there? And I just thought I'd bring it up for a discussion here today. But other than that, I sure support the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, thank you, Representative Ellis.
I have a question.
Oh, I'm sorry. Chairman Huff.
Was there any consideration given to the dedicated fund increasing that for education? Or what was the thought on, at least on Hess's part?
Well, through the chair, Representative Hoffman, there's always a proclivity on the part of the Hess Committee to try and find new funding sources for public education. This is one that we are advised not to play around with because any kind of significant increase of dedicating funds to that fund that was grandfathered in under the Constitution would damage its constitutional protections. And so we stayed away from that issue. It's something we have discussed before in other contexts in the Hess Committee, but we decided not to take that on because we think we'd lose it.
Every time I hear that dedicated tax, it makes me think of one of our elementary schools in the Mat-Su Borough. It was a school that was constructed before statehood, paid for by that 3.5% tax on tobacco. And I remember when we paid the final payment on the $78,000 that built that school. I wonder how many schools we have today that we could bill for $78,000 that still houses many classrooms of elementary students. Representative Burns.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Ellis, I do believe that you and I both attended the same meeting on Saturday, and I believe one of the messages we heard loud and clear as it addressed the subject of taxes was that the people, and I believe each instance except one addressing us, that they would look for budget cuts prior to any new taxes, and if the budget weren't cut, they would not be supporting taxes. So I'd like to know if you have specifically come up with recommendations to cut the budget before we institute new taxes.
Through the chair, Representative Barnes, we were at the same hearing, and I have gotten the message loud and clear. In fact, I'd received it before the budget workshops in Anchorage, and have a whole list of things that I will recommend in various finance subcommittees on which I serve and in the majority caucus for reductions in state spending. One of the areas that I have a great deal of trepidation about budget cuts in, and we will definitely continue our search for reasonable cuts to be made, but I have a difficult time in reducing health programs and things that are constitutionally mandated by the state constitution. And so as we are trying to confront this, you know, very real challenge of reducing the budget, we'll go through the health budget, because I don't think that's any sacred cow any more than other programs that I'd like to see maintained. But this $9.5 million new dollars is a way that we can maintain health programs, one of the highest calls on state resources. So I'm looking forward to working with you to make those budget reductions and fill in some of the gaps with these new revenues, because the tobacco's not paying its way currently, and it ought to.
Representative Barnes.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Ellis, I know that you understand that I have always been in opposition to new taxes, or to taxes on the people that I felt were unwarranted and unjustified. I won't say that a cigarette tax is not warranted or justified, because I don't have the medical facts before me to make that statement, nor do you have the facts before you, I believe, to make the statement in the other direction. However, until I see the budget cuts, I just want you to know I'll continue to vote no on taxes.
Okay. Thank you, Representative. Okay, at this time I'd like to move to teleconference, and first we'd like to hear from Mr. Dwight Lee. Mr. Lee, can you hear us?
Yes, sir, I'm right here.
Okay, Mr. Lee, you have the floor.
Okay, thanks a lot. My name is Dwight Lee, and I'll have the opportunity, by the way, to talk to you face-to-face Wednesday, and I'm looking forward to that. As some of you may know, I'm in Alaska this week under the sponsorship of Common Sense for Alaska to discuss the tax issue generally and the future of the Alaskan economy. I'm a professor of economics at the University of Georgia. I'm on leave this year and visiting Washington University in St. Louis. And during my career, I've specialized in the economics of taxation, having involved and written in this area for the better part of my career. And one type of taxation that I have analyzed and written about in some detail is excise taxation. And in most cases, excise taxes are simply very inefficient and unfair taxes for reasons I'm going to in just a second. And it's especially true with the cigarette excise tax. I think that the problems with the cigarette excise tax are actually magnified here in the state of Alaska. And because of the work that I have done in this area, and because of my views on excise taxes, views that are widely shared, I might add, among economists, I have been asked to comment on the proposed 19-cent increase in the excise tax on cigarettes here in Alaska. There's two general points that I'd like to make. One is that the proposed tax increase will do a great deal of harm to Alaska's retailers and merchants, and probably will not do a great deal to raise tax revenues that you were talking about. And secondly, the increase would impose a disproportionate burden on those least able to pay it. Let me talk about the effect on Alaska's retailers first. Cigarettes are the number one product sold in convenience stores around the nation. Nationwide, on average, they represent 19% of all convenience store sales. Cigarettes also contribute a great deal to drugstore sales. They contribute almost 10% of total sales in drugstores. The proposed 19-cent increase in the cigarette excise tax, I'm convinced, would have a significantly adverse effect on these sales in the state of Alaska. I think it's useful to consider what happened to cigarette sales in Alaska after the last increase in the cigarette excise tax. In 1986, the state excise tax was increased on cigarettes and increased to 8 cents a pack. In 1985, the year before that increase, per capita cigarette sales in Alaska was 128.9 packs, which was almost 7 packs more than the national average. In 1987, the year after the tax increase, the per capita cigarette sales in Alaska had dropped to 110.4 packs, which was almost 6 packs less than the national average. And according to the numbers that I've been able to find, in 1988, the per capita cigarette sales had plummeted to only 80 packs per capita in Alaska, 33 packs less than the national average. Now, this is a significant drop. And I think there's one thing we can be sure of, and that is that this drop does not reflect a similar drop in cigarette smoking in the state of Alaska. Nationally, the per capita decline in cigarette smoking has been about 1.5% per year. I think what's going on here, the most obvious source of this decline, I believe, are the large military bases that exist next to Alaska's two major population centers, Anchorage and Fairbanks. Cigarettes acquired from a local military base are $1.60 a carton cheaper than they are at the local convenience store. And if the proposed 19 cents per pack increase goes into effect, then the individual who buys cigarettes through a military base will save $3.50 a carton. And this doesn't mean, of course, that the individual has to have access to the military base, him or herself. Knowing people who do is sufficient, and that's not difficult because, as I understand it, 12% of Alaska's population is in the military, the highest percentage in the nation. So it'd be quite easy for people to avoid this tax. Based on this responsiveness to cigarette sales, the excise tax in Alaska, I made a calculation that I admit is fairly rough, but I think it's reasonable, and that is that if the tax goes through, there will be about a 19.4% decrease in cigarette sales for Alaskan retailers. And this works out a little bit over $10,560,000 loss in sales a year from cigarettes alone. Studies also indicate that every time the sale of a carton of cigarettes is lost, there's an additional loss of about $5 and collateral purchases. So this represents another $4,227,000 in lost sales for a total, according to my calculations, of almost $15 million in lost sales for Alaskan retailers as a direct consequence of the proposed hike in the cigarette excise tax. Now, I think this is unfortunate for a number of reasons. It's clearly unfortunate from the point of view of retailers in Alaska. But I think it's reasonable to argue that the biggest problem that Alaska faces today is that of making a smooth transition over time from a predominantly oil-based economy to a more diverse economy. And clearly, imposing a $15 million sales loss on your small merchants and retailers not going to be very helpful in this regard. All retailers and merchants are an important part of a diverse and healthy economy. I simply don't think it's in the long run interest of the Alaskan economy to impose this kind of sales loss on them. Let me now shift to a second issue, and I'll be brief on this. And that's another, second, I think, serious problem with increasing the cigarette excise tax. That is that the excise tax on cigarettes is extremely regressive. It imposes a far higher burden as a percentage of income on the poor than it does on the wealthy. Excise taxes in general tend to be regressive taxes, but But the cigarette excise tax has been shown in any number of studies to be the most regressive of all taxes that we levy in the United States. For example, in a study done by the Citizens for Tax Justice, a Washington, D.C.-based group, it was found that excise taxes on tobacco products took 7 times more as a percentage of income from those with incomes below $9,000 a year but compared to those with incomes in excess of $60,000 a year. And this disproportionate burden on the poor, I'm pretty confident, is even worse in Alaska than that figure indicates, because the poor citizens in Alaska are more likely to live in the remote areas a long distance from military bases. And so they are more likely to end up paying the increased tax that the wealthier citizens of Alaska will be escaping through cigarettes from military bases. Let me conclude by saying that I simply see little advantage that the state will realize from the proposed increase in cigarette excise taxes. But I see some very serious disadvantages associated with that increase. And those disadvantages will take the form of placing a disproportionate burden on the poorer citizens of Alaska and of reducing the incomes and threatening the livelihoods of many retailers and merchants in the state of Alaska. That concludes my formal remarks. I'll be glad to respond to any questions you might have.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Lee. We do have some questions. First, we have Representative Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Lee, I think one factor that's not been mentioned here is the positive social effects of discouraging smoking, which is very threatening to people's health, and particularly to young people who have been shown to be the most sensitive to increase in cost of these products. I was interested in your view of the appropriateness of using taxation as a way to discourage use of this harmful substance.
Mr. Lee, did you hear the question?
Yeah, because I have given that some thought. I think there's two problems with the use of the cigarette excise tax as a way of trying to discourage teenage smoking. The first is that the excise tax is an awfully blunt instrument for addressing that concern. It's a blunt instrument in that it imposes a cost on all smokers, particularly the poorest smokers, and threatens the livelihood, as I said, of many of Alaskans' merchants and small retailers. And it does so in order to address a concern that I think, anyway, is best handled by education and parental discipline. And secondly, I just don't think an increase in the tax is likely to have much effect on teenage smoking. For the reason that I've already discussed, I think it's pretty clear that the proposed tax increase will have a much bigger impact on where Alaskans purchase their cigarettes than on how many cigarettes they actually smoke.
Thank you. Representative Barnes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Lee, being very aware of purchases of products, be they cigarettes or otherwise, from military bases, I'm believing that you have left a misimpression on this committee, because it is my belief, and in fact my knowledge, that the only way that a military person can dispose, or their dependents dispose of products purchased on a military base would be illegal. And thus, I believe what you're talking about is a black, that you're talking about a black market. And I don't believe that the military people that are stationed in Alaska would be black marketing cigarettes from the military bases. And for your information, they're only allowed to purchase 4 cartons at a time.
Yes. Any response, Mr. Lee?
Well, you know, I don't want to make any disparaging remarks about the people in Alaska. I'm sure that there's many people that are reluctant to do things because they're illegal. But the fact is, with the type of difference in prices we're talking about, evidence from around the country, talk about North Carolina versus New York, for example, where there's a much smaller difference in the price of cigarettes than we're talking about here, widespread smuggling takes place. People will do that, and it doesn't take everyone. I'm convinced that you're right, that most people are law-abiding, but it doesn't take everyone in order to have a big impact on the type of on where people end up buying their cigarettes.
Okay, Mr. Lee, the one question I had had to do with the effects on the retailers. If we were to implement this bill, it would raise the tax in Alaska to approximately 35 cents per tax. The information I have before me states that in the state of Minnesota, the tax presently is 38 cents per pack, or 3 cents more than what is being proposed. Have these negative impacts on the retailers taken place in Minnesota, or is it only an effect that will take place in Alaska because of our unique situation here, with our two largest population bases being next to military bases?
I'm sorry I don't have the exact figures with me, but I do remember the case in Minnesota. In 1987, they raised their tax by 12.5%, and in 1988, sales had dropped by 12.1%. There are several other examples of this. In Oklahoma, they raised the tax by, I think it was 4.8%. Maybe it was Utah. And, no, I'm not exactly sure of some of these figures, but in Utah, I think it was they raised the tax by 8%, and the sales dropped by almost 16%. There's a number of states, usually states are surrounded by other states that have lower taxes, where there have been dramatic declines in the cigarette sales within the state immediately or soon after an increase in the excise tax. And again, this is very predictable. People can save a lot of money. If you take a two-pack-a-day smoker, they can save hundreds of dollars a year by saving a few cents per pack on cigarettes.
Thank you. Are there any other questions for Mr. Lee at this time? Chairman Hoffman.
Is tobacco a major product in the state of Georgia where you come from as a major producer?
It's not one of the major producers, but it's a fairly significant producer.
Thank you.
It's a fairly important part of the economy in Georgia. Yes.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay. Thank you, Mr. Lee, if you'd remain online in case any questions. Mr. Cooper.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Neil Cooper. I reside in Anchorage, Alaska. I own a small business in town here. And I'd like to speak to you today as a businessman. And I'm certain I don't have to make any prefacing remarks concerning the condition of the business community in Alaska. We all know how rough it's been. I am very opposed to any form of taxation, especially raising existing taxes. And there's one item in this HB 80. Excuse me 1 minute, please. Yes. I'm sorry. Allowing municipalities to levy and collect taxes, and I'm very much opposed to a municipality being able to do this. My concern, of course, would be it would open up a considerable amount of competition outside the municipality, thereby causing me to lose business and the municipality to not benefit by the tax, therefore making it probably worthless. Put that in perspective for you as an analogy. I'm sure you're well aware that we have a motor vehicle inspection program here in Anchorage, and there has been a rash of people who have illegally registered their cars in, let's say, Palmer and Wasilla, just to beat the $35 a year that costs between the municipal permit and having the inspection done. So I think allowing municipalities to be able to tax anything other than the general sales tax, and even that would cause a tremendous drop of revenue here in Anchorage. I don't think it's right to target a specific business or a specific tax. This is a form of discriminatory taxation, which I'm not a constitutional lawyer, but I'm sure that somebody would argue that. I don't know what else to tell you except that this HB 80, very much against it, and I think it's just taxation and more regulation that we don't need. I'm open for any questions or comments.
Okay, do we have any questions of Mr. Cooper? I don't see any, so thank you very much, sir. Next, we'll move to some folks who have signed up to testify here. And the first person that we'll have is Rocky Potnick Weller. While she's coming up, I'd like to, I know Representative Copen and I like to look at history a little bit, but the first white man from Europe to, I guess, take part or to see the activity of smoking was when Christopher Columbus lost one of his ships off of Hispaniola, and upon going to ashore, many of the sailors that Columbus had did sight some of the natives of the area sitting in a circle blowing smoke from a tube. And speculated, of course, that it might not have been tobacco that they had in the tube, but something else. But that was white man's first experience. But also, tobacco was the first cash crop of Jamestown, too. So it was really the first product shipped from the New World back to Europe. And in many ways, it spread around the world much faster than Christianity, for good or bad. You're on.
Hi, thank you. For the record, my name is Rocky Plotnick Weller, and I'm here this afternoon as the president-elect of the American Lung Association of Alaska. In addition to that, I'm the only person from Alaska who sits on the national board for the American Lung Association, and I am a trained health educator. I've been doing smoking cessations here in Juneau for 3 years now, helping people who want to quit. And last year, I was fortunate to have a lot of experience both in urban and rural communities working in programs dealing with the war on drugs, substance abuse. And unfortunately, I want to remind you that my dad, who was a member of the House of Representatives, died of lung cancer, and he smoked two packs a day for 30 years. So with that, I'm really honored to be here today and present my testimony for House Bill 80. The American Lung Association is in favor of this piece of legislation, and it's important to remember during the discussion that smoking does remain the single most important preventable cause of death in our society. It's killing 390,000 Americans each year. That's the equivalent of 1,000 people per day. It would be like 3 747s going down every single day in the U.S. The age at which children start smoking keeps falling. Of the 20% of high school seniors who admit to being steady smokers, most started by the 8th grade, and 25% say they started smoking by the 6th grade. I would like to say that of the people I've helped quit smoking, over 50% of them reported that they started smoking by age 14. A recent survey by the American Council on Education shows a dramatic increase in the number of college freshmen who smoke. From 1987 to 1988, the rate of smoking increased from 8.9 to 10.1%. And according to Dr. George Lundberg, who is the editor for the Journal of the American Medical Association, he wanted to put the war on drugs into perspective and said that tobacco kills 1,000 Americans each day, alcohol kills approximately 350 Americans per day, sedatives and depressants kill between 5 and 20 Americans each day. Yeah, but I need a place to put the papers. And cocaine kills between 2 and 10 Americans each day. I think that's a real significant piece of information to keep in mind. It's also important to remind all of you that tobacco or cigarettes is considered one of the gateway drugs. I just spent this weekend working with a group of educators revising a health curriculum, and it's right there. It's considered one of the gateway drugs, drugs that lead to other drug use. Today, there are fewer legal restrictions on children's access to tobacco products than there were in 1964. The National Conference of State Legislatures does report that excise taxes do deter the use of alcohol and cigarettes, especially smoking among teenagers. And the last really important point I want to make in terms of my facts, cigarettes and other forms of tobacco are addicting. I know that the Surgeon General has come out with his report on, you know, nicotine as addictive. And, you know, I know from my personal experience working with people, there are people who are recovering from alcohol and have said they've had a tougher time giving up their cigarettes than the alcohol. A couple of really quick other comments I'd like to make. Their support for a cigarette excise tax increase relates primarily to the causal relationship between higher cigarette prices and lower cigarette consumption, particularly among young people. We've heard testimony today that, you know, from an economic point of view, that this might decrease some income for some people. And nobody's talked about the tobacco industry losing money. I'm here to maintain that the health costs that will be incurred by the people who continue to smoke cigarettes over the years are far greater than the economic losses that some people are talking about today. To the extent that the tobacco industry should bear some responsibility for increased government health care expenditures, the cigarette excise tax represents a user fee. We support this contention and maintain that cigarettes are unique and distinct from all other consumer products, and that cigarettes are the only consumer product that kills when used precisely as intended. Many argue against excise tax increases, suggesting that such taxes are regressive in nature. Well, we firmly maintain that there is nothing more regressive than the financial costs that accrue from smoking-related illness. And with that, I would be glad to address any questions or comments that you have and encourage you to support House Bill 80. Thanks.
Does anyone have any questions of Rocky? No, we thank you. Whoops, Representative Barnes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. How are the babies, Rocky?
Really great. I wish they had a grandpa I could share them with.
Thank you very much, Rocky. And next we have Duane Peoples.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Duane Peoples, Division of Public Health, Department of Health and Social Services. For brevity's sake, the department echoes Ms. Wheeler's comments about the problems of smoking. While we do not have readily on hand specific figures of how the cost of smoking is affecting the state of Alaska, nationally the cost is estimated in the billions, figures running as high as $20 billion as a result of loss of productivity and extra health care costs associated with smoking. It is a leading cause of cancer, heart disease, and other cardiovascular medical problems, which result not only in extensive medical care, but in premature death. In Alaska, this has a great impact upon our health care delivery system and upon the state's role in that, since the state is a very dominant financer of health care in this state. So with that, I would close and just say the division and the department does support HB 80 and its effects upon determining and causing reductions in smoking. Thank you.
Does anyone have any questions for Mr. Peoples? I'd only have one question if you were from the Department of Law, and that was whether we could make it retroactive and go back and sue John Ralph for importing that tobacco into the United States.
I probably not, as we want to know.
Mr. Gary Miller. I've heard of similar suits.
Exporter. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Gary Miller. I'd like to make a comment about something the tobacco lobbyist said about the poor being hit harder with this tax. George Carlin, one of my favorite comedians, talks about words that don't go together, and one of my favorite lines is military intelligence. When he talks about the poor being hit harder, if they're poor, why are they spending money on cigarettes? I don't understand that. I've got two young kids that are rapidly approaching the age of peer pressure for trying to smoke. The tobacco company spends $1 billion a year trying to hook new people, including my kids, and I resent that. I think this excise tax, however you want to call it, is going to increase the price of cigarettes, and that the studies that show as the cigarette prices go up, more smokers stop smoking. And in my case, which is really good, it also stops a lot of new smokers from starting. I don't want my kids to start smoking. My kids fall in the same category as these poor people. They don't have a lot of money, and they're not going to spend the money on cigarettes as the price goes up. So I encourage you to vote for this bill.
Thank you. Does anyone have any questions of Mr. Miller? Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
And next we have Sherry Gull. And did anyone else want to be heard on this bill today? Sherry?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Sherry Gall, and I'm representing the Alaska Women's Lobby. And I'd like to speak today in support of House Bill 80. And we support this bill not only because of the obvious health benefits to be derived if people were to be somewhat deterred from smoking, but also because of its revenue-generating ability. It is probably well known to all of you that as an advocate for women and children, I'm very concerned about the budget crisis that we face right now and the $600 million that we need to make up in order to preserve some of the services in our budget. And when we hear that the legislature would consider cutting back COLAs on AFDC or short funding public education, we felt that it was important enough for the lobby to start to look at revenue generating measures and to lend some support to them as well, because although we recognize that the budget will need to be reduced and that we would like to preserve some of the important constitutional requirements in our state budget, we also recognize that it just can't be done by merely cutting the budget, because if you cut out three or four departments, it wouldn't make up the difference. And so we would like to lend our support to this measure because it will increase revenues and hopefully will save a few lives.
Chairman Hoffman.
No comments on the effects of nicotine on the unborn?
I guess that perhaps someday we will see warning signs about that as well.
Okay, any other questions for Mrs. Gull? Thank you. I just have one question of Mr. Lee, if he's still online. Mr. Lee, are you still online?
Yes, sir, right here.
Okay, in the bill that we have before us, and this is Chairman Larson, we really have two concepts. One is to raise the tax, and the other is to free municipalities from the sales tax limit. Do you know if we have any other state in the United States where the local government decides, say, whether they are to be smokeless or not within their boundaries, or have the ability to...
Smokeless, or whether they can put a tax on that doesn't apply statewide?
Yeah, let's put it that way. That's more correct.
Yes, in Illinois, for example, Cook County has quite a bit higher tax than the rest of Illinois. Cook County, of course, encompasses Chicago. Within Chicago city limits, they have even a higher tax. They have a city tax. And it's interesting to note that cigarette sales drop off dramatically as you move from downstate Illinois into Cook County. And then they drop off dramatically again when you go from Cook County into Chicago. And it's not because people in Chicago smoke less than people in downstate Illinois. It's simply because people buy their cigarettes in the low-tax areas. But the short answer is yes. There are municipal differences within states.
Do you know of any municipality that prohibits the sale of tobacco?
I don't think so. I have never heard of anything like that. My guess is it would kind of be ludicrous, and no municipality would attempt it, although I don't want to rule anything out. I just read in the paper recently that Sausalito, California, just north of San Francisco, and the city council has ruled their city a cholesterol-free city. So there's no telling what some municipality will do somewhere. But I don't know of any no-smoking
cities. Don't suggest anything here.
Thank you once again for your testimony.
Well, I'm looking forward to talking to you Wednesday face-to-face.
Thank you. Okay, at this time then we'll move the discussion to the committee. What action does the committee wish in relation to committee substitute for House Bill number 80-S? Representative Allman.
I move that we pass the bill up from committee with individual recommendations and ask for unanimous consent.
Yes.
Okay, hearing objections, discussion? Representative Allman.
I note in the backup material that has been presented to us by Representative Ellis that there are 35 states that hire a levy a higher tax than Alaska does. And so if some of the argument here is, gee, Alaska's going to be a high-tax state, it looks to me like we're definitely going to be moving toward more of the average if we raise our tax than where we are today. I might also note that I recently did a budget survey here in my community, and 90% of the respondents said that they favored an increase in alcohol and cigarette taxes. It was by far the highest and most popular test in terms of asking people, do you want to pay an additional tax? And 90% of them said, this is an area where we would feel comfortable paying an additional tax. And I think it does reflect a consideration that it is not the kind of conduct that we want to encourage. It is something that presents a rather significant health hazard, that we ought to do what we can to discourage it and at the same time raise some revenues for some very necessary health programs in the state of Alaska. So I would encourage all members to vote yes.
Okay, we have the motion before us to move from committee with individual recommendations. We had objections. Are we ready for the question?
Question.
Okay. Please call the question.
Representative Slackhammer?
Yes.
Representative Ulmer?
Yes.
Representative Wallace?
Yes.
Representative Barnes?
No.
Representative Brown?
Yes.
Representative Kopanen?
Yes.
Representative Phillips?
No.
Representative Rico?
Yes.
Representative Schultz?
No.
Representative Hoffman?
Yes.
Representative Larson?
Yes. Okay. Please note then that committee substitute for House Bill number 80 has moved from committee with individual recommendations.
Happy birthday, Johnny. Johnny? Happy birthday.
Next we have House Bill 169, an act establishing the Business Incentive Training Program. And I think we could also take any testimony then in relation to House Bill 170, which is an act making a special appropriation to the Department of Community and Regional Affairs for the Business Incentive Training Program and providing for an effective date. Now, House Bill 169 is an act establishing the Business Incentive Training Program, and it's also sponsored by Representative Ellis. So instead of going through a long dissertation here in relation to it, let me recognize Representative Ellis.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I hope now we can work on part two of my birthday wish for today with consideration of these bills. I don't think anybody on this committee needs me to describe the kind of grim economic situation many of our villages and towns across the state are suffering at the moment. It's a highly competitive world economy. That phrase has almost become a cliche, but it's cliche at this point because it's so very true. House Bill 169 and 170 seek to put the state of Alaska in a more competitive situation among the other states in the nation and being able to attract new business enterprise to the state of Alaska. 169, as you said, Mr. Chairman, establishes the Business Incentive Training Fund, and House Bill 170 is a modest appropriation of $300,000 for that purpose. 169, the establishment fund, would allow the state of Alaska, through the private industry councils, made up of experienced business people and people experienced in job training, to be able to make grants to local communities that are, or to businesses locating in communities across the state of Alaska that are new to the state of Alaska, or that are existing Alaskan businesses that wish to diversify into a new technology or new area, to pay 50% of the training costs for those employees. It's my contention that no business that come new business to our state or existing business should be able to use the excuse that there are no qualified or trained Alaskans available to take these new jobs. And if a business, a new business or an existing business, will promise to employ Alaskans in those positions after they're trained, the state will match those training costs 50-50. In the case of people who experience significant or multiple barriers to employment, and there are a number of those, that the state would match those training costs 4-1. So we're accomplishing a number of good purposes with this legislation. I point out that on tab 5 of your packets there in the backup, there's a 1985 Alaska State Department of Labor survey. And when businesses were questioned as to why they employ non-Alaskans or they bring people in, 60% of them said that their reason for doing that thing, that I think all of us agree would is not the best situation we could have for our Alaskan workers, they say that there are not trained Alaskans to take those positions. And as I said, if this legislation becomes law, there will be no such excuse in existence in the future. Another point is that most states already have similar state-funded programs in place, and I'd refer you to tab number 4 of the backup, which just gives a few brief examples. The state of Massachusetts has a customized industrial training program where the state matches private sector costs for job training. Targeted at, we're not talking about fairy tale kinds of jobs or jobs that we hope to come to the state of Alaska. We're talking about jobs that would actually exist to employ those Alaskans. In the state of California, a customized industrial training called Employment Training Panel that would carry out a similar function there. Connecticut Labor Training Program. Almost every state in the country has a similar business incentive. And when you just stack up the business incentives, the list in some of these national publications, you flip through and there will be 8 or 10 things in an average state of tax incentives or training incentives used to bring new business, foreign and domestic investment, new capitalization into those states. When you get to Alaska, it's embarrassing. There's nothing there except ADA. ADA will assist you in loans if you have a large industrial project to try and fund. We'll consider bonding for some of the costs, the infrastructure costs, for example, Red Dog. But you look through the rest and there are no incentives for businesses to locate here or for existing Alaskan businesses to diversify into new and untried technologies or areas of manufacturing or other kinds of enterprises. So we don't stack up well against other states. I think many of you are familiar with the example of Federal Express. That's quite a success story for South Central Alaska. There was an investment made by the municipality of Anchorage to match job training costs with Federal Express so that they would guarantee to employ local residents. That's worked out beautifully. It's been a great partnership between the public and private sectors and many new jobs for our local community. There's very little administrative cost involved in this proposal because the management is already in place. The private industry councils, which administer Federal Job Training Partnership Act, JTPA, money, have an excellent track record on job placement. As I mentioned, not jobs we hope to come here, but jobs that actually exist. And so you can tailor these kinds of job training programs to the exact industry that is considering moving here or expanding their operations. It's a positive approach to local hire. It's a partnership between the public and private sectors, and I think it's a very wise investment of public funds. Our state's ability to compete for new capital investment, foreign and domestic, is threatened by our lack of incentives for these kinds of programs. So with that, I'd recommend the project to the committee. I originally had a much larger appropriations bill attached to this project because I think there's a lot more we could be doing. I honed that down to a very basic $300,000 as sort of a startup, kind of a test case on this kind of business incentive. And I think it's an affordable amount of money. I'm trying to bring revenue measures to the Finance Committee in addition to things that are an investment of public funds. We can see how it goes. If it doesn't work out, we always have prerogatives in the future to cut it off. But I think it's something worth trying. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Representative Schultz.
More for a statement than anything. I really think, you know, I see pieces of legislation like this come along, and of course, being from the private sector and everything else, I support this kind of a concept. However, it just does not, after the last piece of legislation, and then this one, saying we're going to provide incentive to the private sector. It's almost as if we're taking $10 million to $15 million worth of revenue away from the private sector, and then in this bill, we're rehabilitating them for $300,000 for training programs and incentives. The two things just are just completely opposite of one another of what we're talking about. It just doesn't make a lot of sense to me. I support the concept, probably support the legislation, but you know, you got a piece of legislation comes through that costs the private sector $10-15 million, and then you have one saying, okay, we're gonna give $300,000 back to you to rehabilitate you into some kind of a training program, you know.
Tongue in cheek.
Yeah, right.
It's easier to retrain a live body than it is to train a dead one.
I guess. That's the concept.
Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I can't resist this one. When Mr. Lee was testifying on the previous bill and talking about the impact on small retailers, I would like to see more of those facts. Representative Barnes questioned me about medical findings, and it's absolutely true that on the previous bill, I don't have here in my folder medical findings about the negative health impacts of nicotine, which the Surgeon General has likened to being as addictive and destructive as heroin. But those materials are available, and I didn't mean to not answer Representative Barnes before and lead her to believe that such medical findings don't exist, so I will follow up on that. But in terms of retailers, at least in my community of Anchorage, an interesting trend has occurred. Many of the mom-and-pop kind of small retailers, the neighborhood 24-hour convenience stores, have been bought up recently by the Southland Corporation. The Quick Stop Corporation, which was a locally owned business, no longer exists. The Southland Corporation, one of the nation's largest corporations, and one of its most profitable, by the way, and cigarettes are a big portion of that corporation's profitability, have now purchased almost all of the, they purchased all of the Quick Stops and most of the 24-hour convenience stores in Anchorage. So there is an interesting and very significant export of capital from the state of Alaska to that outside corporation that's going on. So I wanted to bring that to the attention of the representative from Chicken, because I think we would probably all agree, if we had a chance to talk about it more, that that's not a positive thing, and a negative trend in the ownership of small retail businesses, at least in South Central Alaska.
Representative Barnes?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm not meaning to go back and rehash another bill, but since the representative did bring it up, when he brings the other information to us, I would also like him to bring the hazards of smoking marijuana along with it.
Can we?
Mr. Chairman, to Representative Barnes, I'd be happy to provide the milk crate full of loose papers that was provided to the Hess Committee by the Senate as backup. All those materials are available to members, and I'd be happy to provide them.
Mr. Chairman, and in that regard, I have questions on this particular bill. I think the one good thing that I see about it, it purports to help local hire, and certainly I am for local hire and doing anything I can to help it. But directing your attention to page 1 of the bill, line 17, beginning with the word and retraining existing employees to qualify for promotions to positions requiring improved skills and offering better compensation. I don't personally feel that that's the state's responsibility. I feel that is the education system and the individual's responsibility, and I would like to know if you ever considered in drafting this piece of legislation that we probably have one of the most generous student loan programs for both vocational and college education of any place in the nation, and why it is that we're not asking people to avail themselves to those programs rather than asking for more dollars out of the state's general fund today to do something that the individual and the private sector themselves should be doing.
Representative Ellis.
Mr. Chairman, to Representative Barnes. Representative Barnes, we do have a good system of we did have a system of community colleges, but now we have a university system that attempts to provide vocational training and other kinds of training required for job advancement. One of the purposes of this legislation is to address the training needs of corporations that are expanding into new and untried kinds of projects and businesses here in the state of Alaska. For example, Geographic Information Systems is something that it's a computerized system of data management that's used by a number of our state agencies and some of our private agencies because it's very important to the development of our natural resources. There is currently not offered in the state of Alaska any kind of program through our university system or through any kind of private school that avails itself of the student loan program to train people in that very important field, an emerging high-tech kind of field that's very important to the state of Alaska for whenever you build, say, for example, the gas pipeline. If we had a GIS program in place, we would not be hiring people from outside of the state of Alaska to take very well-paying, good-paying jobs in geographic information systems as analysts in those systems. So that's one example of an emerging technology that's very important to our economy and to future resource development where training and education is not offered in the state of Alaska. So when we're putting an emphasis on new kinds of enterprises, I would hope that our regular university system and private schools would keep up with that kind of thing. But things are moving very rapidly in the economy. And this legislation targets, when we work with Federal Express, they have some very, very specific training requirements for the people that they will employ. The University of Alaska does not offer that kind of training. Federal Express wants to offer that in conjunction with, and in that case, the money's coming out of the municipality of Anchorage, to train those people so they won't be bringing in people from their, as many people in from their national headquarters. They'll be training Alaskans. And so that's one of the areas that we're getting to with that language. I'd be happy to work with committee members to try and modify that language if people wish to take into account our existing educational infrastructure.
Representative Barnes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I personally believe that if the representative from downtown Anchorage knows of any programs that's emerging technology within our community that needs to be addressed, he should be talking to the Board of Regents and asking that they certainly get off the stick and offer those types of programs within the university. But beyond that, I do believe that there's skill centers that we could go to our unions to ask them to offer training programs. I just don't feel that this is the state's business. It's an individual, it's a private sector, it's the public sector's business to train or to see to it that their people are trained. And that's all I have to say, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Kopanen?
We on the line? No. Yes. Looking at the program, what it does is provide an incentive to business to provide on-the-job training, and because it bears part of the cost. So it is of assistance to small business generally that usually cannot afford the time or the effort necessary to upgrade people. So that in reply to Representative Barnes. However, I do have one just a question. The material on tab 4 seems to outline a lot of different programs in different states, and I would like to pursue looking at those programs. What document was that drawn from?
Representative Kopanen, I can find out, or Mr. Chairman, through the chair to Representative Kopanen, I can find out the exact title of that publication for you and provide the full text. I just chose to take some examples of other states that offer this incentive. And by the way, many other states have chosen a more costly kind of approach, setting up new alphabet soup kind of agencies to address job training. And I think the proposal I'm putting forward is uniquely tailored to Alaska and is a vote of confidence for our private industry councils. It's business and the private sector that requests these kinds of incentives. It's not government generally that comes up with these ideas. So I'm not, Mr. Chairman, trying to take credit for an idea here. These are private sector kind of suggestions through government that I'm carrying along as a proposal. Also, Representative Kopanen is very correct. Most small businesses in the state, especially at a time of economic hardship, hardly have the kinds of money in their budgets to be able to expand into new industries. It's too risky when you can't sustain a high training cost for something that may or may not pan out. But we're talking about the kinds of skills and training that are required to make those kinds of new jobs possible. And like I said before, Mr. Chairman, I'll once again extend the offer to work with Representative Barnes or any other member to try and come up with more acceptable language, because I'm certainly not trying to harm the private sector or our educational offerings currently in the state. I'm trying to offer the or expand the kinds of alternatives to make things happen.
Representative Rieger and then Chairman Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The program that's outlined in this bill is, is this program outlined, is it covered under the JTPA federal funds? I mean, could federal JTPA funds do this?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Rieger, I'm not, I don't believe so, but there is someone with us today from the Private Industry Council who could speak much better to federal regulations than can I.
Okay. Well, I guess the concern I have is whether, you know, I'd like to know what, because of the complaints you outlined, you know, what we're doing with our vocational education already, and I don't want to echo the comments made already, but I mean, there are big dollars in the budget already. I mean, in the Department of Education, there's $7 million in adult and voc ed, plus another $13.3 million in voc rehab, plus $4.6 million in the Alaska Voc Tech Center, plus another million in the Kotzebue Tech Center, $17 million of just federal funds in the Community Regional Affairs JTPA program. And now we're putting another thing in because we're saying there's still a need and putting $300,000 behind it in the companion bill. And that's in addition to the University of Alaska program that they have. And I'm not sure that where we're going, if there's what adds up to probably $50 million going into vocational education, why is there still a concern that we need another bill and another $300,000?
Representative Ellis?
Through the chair, Representative Rieger, this legislation represents a new approach. It's a partnership approach where we're matching the job training expenses of private industry. And as I mentioned, there are people here who can speak better to the existing programs and how they differ.
Well, Mr. Chairman, you know, if it is a new approach, and I don't dispute, you know, whether it's a good approach or not, at least at this point, I would suggest we look at whether we could redirect some of the existing multi-millions of dollars that we're putting into this to this new approach and see if we can do a better job with the money we have.
I would suspect, Representative Rieger, that if these two bills do pass, that that be in charge of the subcommittee to look to see if indeed we could find that money to fund this program elsewhere in the budget. Both Community and Regional Affairs and the Department of Education could be places to look. Representative Barnes?
Well, Mr. Chairman, in looking at this bill, I don't see that it's all that much different than the one passed by the other representative from downtown Anchorage. And she certainly recognized the problem that we have with this budget this year and did go out of her way to address a bill that we could be supportive of. I don't see that with this bill, because there is all kinds of money, as you just had read to you, for vocational education and job training. And I think that you need to look at those existing resources before you bring another new bill before us to spend money.
Representative Copeland.
Well, as I understand the bill and looking at it, it doesn't, provides an incentive to private business to take on the job training programs rather than providing the direct technical training that you might get at the Seward Skill Center or Kotzebue. But those skills learned at the Voc Tech Center have to be tried out in real life, and what it does essentially is subsidize the, shall we say, the apprenticeship